Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. Today I thought it would be interesting to discuss the two words that devastated rugby, broken time. These two words split rugby apart in 1895 and would shape the subsequent future of rugby union. But why were they so incendiary? To find out, we have to go back to 1886 when the Rugby Football Union voted to make rugby an entirely amateur sport and outlawed all forms of payments, gifts and other rewards for playing rugby. This, they hoped, would make rugby safe from the professionalism that they believed had ruined soccer. But for rugby in the north of England, the issue of amateurism was not as simple as the leaders of the RFU believed. The attempts to impose amateurism on northern rugby in the late 1880s created an atmosphere of paranoia. Team selections were disrupted by the arbitrary banning of players who had been convicted of violating the amateur rules. Even worse, from the point of view of club officials, fixture lists could be decimated by suspensions of opponents or of the club itself for breaking amateur regulations, leading to the loss of significant amounts of money. Many feared that amateurism would actually decimate rugby's popularity in Lancashire and Yorkshire, as a player pointed out in 1891. To carry out amateurism to its logical conclusion would be to depopularise the game and make it the selfish possession of the silver-spooned classes. Moreover, it would deprive the pastime of its ablest and most numerous exponents, who are essentially the working men of the North, and of its most enthusiastic supporters, who are undoubtedly the wage-earning classes. By the spring of 1891, this discontent had led to a campaign to allow players to be compensated for time they had to take off work to play the game, otherwise known as broken time payments. In April of that year, Yorkshire Rugby Union Secretary James Miller of Leeds outlined the case for broken time payments. Rugby is no longer the pastime of the public schools and the leisured classes alone. It has become the sport of the masses, of the wage-earning classes in our great manufacturing centres. That being so, it is unreasonable to expect the same amateurism from the wage-earning classes as from the public schoolmen. It is unfair to expect working men to break time to play football without their being remunerated. Although the Northern clubs felt that broken time payments might be acceptable as a compromise by the RFU leadership, because it was seen as merely compensation for wages lost from work and not open professionalism, the RFU itself was unyielding in its opposition to any types of payments to players. Writing in the 1892 Athletic News Annual, the Reverend Frank Marshall of Huddersfield, but most importantly of the RFU committee, declared that it is far preferable to have two bodies, one amateur and the other professional, than to have the methods of the Football Association imitated by the Rugby Union. Nevertheless, the supporters of broken time payments felt that they could win a majority of rugby union clubs to support broken time. The clubs in the north were thought to outnumber those in the south, and so, in the summer of 1893, the Yorkshire Rugby Union decided to go to that September's annual general meeting of the Rugby Football Union and put the broken time issue to the vote. They were supported in this by the Lancashire Rugby Union, which voted to support broken time payments because the game is both supported and played extensively by the working classes. To make sure of the biggest possible turnout, the Yorkshire Rugby Union chartered a train to take delegates from Yorkshire to the meeting, which was to be held as usual at the Westminster Palace Hotel in London. Tickets cost 10 shillings for a day return or 15 shillings for a 4-day return, and the train consisted of 12 coaches that stopped at 11 of the major towns in West Yorkshire. From the distant parts of Hull and Goole came the wise men of the East. From the fastnesses of Brighouse or the lesser-known regions of the Calder Valley, on they came, described the Yorkshire Evening Post journalist on the train, who also reported that the passengers had a look of determination about every man which told of his zeal in the cause of broken time. At the meeting, James Miller proposed a motion that players be allowed compensation for bona fide loss of time. He argued that the changed conditions that rugby now faced were due to the success of the RFU in popularising the game. The sport was no longer confined to the public schools and universities, but had been taken up by working men. But, said Miller, the RFU now did them an injustice. These men were constantly called upon to lose their wages in order to play for their club or their county, and at the same time they were debarred from recompense for the loss of time involved. Why should not the working man be able to play the game on level terms with the gentleman? He pointed to the example of Harry Bradshaw, a forward from Bramley and a worker at the Newlade Dye Works in Leeds. He had played for England against Ireland in Dublin the previous season and had lost 3 days' pay from work due to travelling to and from the match. In contrast, the gentleman who played in the team alongside him lost nothing. Miller claimed that this could not be called playing on level terms. The game should be played as a sport and not as a source of income. But this did not mean that these players should play it at a loss. If it was legitimate to refund travel expenses, why not refund wages lost? William Cale of the Northumberland Rugby Union opposed the Broken Time proposal, arguing that it is contrary to the true interests of the game and its spirit. Former RFU President Roger Walker of Lancashire doubted that honest working men really wanted to be paid broken time payments, while the Reverend Warner from Devon argued that the amateur gentleman often lost more money playing rugby than the working man. The Reverend Frank Marshall called on those who wanted to pay players to leave the RFU and form their own rugby union. In defence of broken time payments, Dewsbury's Mark Newsom said, "At present, the working man was the only man who suffered anything by playing rugby. He did not play on a level with the other class of players. This motion would put them on an equal footing." Joe Mills of Swinton explained that the working men, who chiefly composed the teams in Lancashire and Yorkshire, felt that they had a grievance and that broken time would put matters right. However, the debate had little bearing on the outcome of the vote, which went against broken time payments by 282 to 136. Immediately after the meeting, the RFU committee met and amended the first bylaw of the RFU constitution to restrict membership to those clubs only entirely composed of amateurs. The reaction of the supporters of broken time was controlled anger. The left-wing Manchester Weekly The Clarion said that the arguments of those who opposed broken time were a reassertion of the typical British snob's comfortable belief that the business of the working man is to work. Providence made him for that purpose. Play was intended for us gentlemen. Across the Pennines, the Yorkshireman Weekly said, "We have at last been boldly told the truth, that if a man cannot to play, he has no right to do so, that rugby football is a game for the classes, and in effect, that the masses are neither more nor less than intruders." While expressing their outrage at the decision, most Northern commentators opposed leaving the RFU. Fortunately, said the Yorkshire Post, Yorkshiremen and Lancastrians, having been beaten at the vote, can take their defeat philosophically. But the RFU leadership was in no mood to take their victory philosophically. Pastime, the weekly edited by N.L. Jackson, one of the most zealous defenders of amateurism, who also led the Corinthian Soccer Club, said that the RFU should remove suspected clubs from membership and expel all those which avowedly sympathise with professionalism or refuse their heartiest cooperation for its detection and suppression. From Scotland, the president of the Scottish Rugby Union expressed the hope that the watchword with regard to professionalism would be no surrender. Rugby was now in a state of open civil war, and the Leeds-based Yorkshire Owl magazine warned prophetically that the English Rugby Union will never stand professionalism in the game, whatever name it is cloaked under. It would have to sacrifice many fine exponents of the game, doubtless, but it would not hesitate. It would lose a good many international games, but it would still not hesitate. It was a prediction that would shortly prove to be 100% correct. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my name is @ColinsTony, and if you want to dig a bit deeper into the history of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at the Rugby Reloaded website at www.rugbyreloaded.com. Until next week, thanks for listening.